I'm Kara Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Hart and Cirque. Listeners, we are bringing you a special crossover event today with the AJP Hart and Cirque podcast. Last month, we talked with senior authors Steve Hauser and Tim McKinsey about cortical bone stem cells' effects on cardiac wound healing. Today, we're chatting with the first authors, Alex Hobby and Gianna Scana, about those same two articles. Cortical bone stem cell-derived exosomes' therapeutic effect on myocardial ischemia reperfusion and cardiac remodeling by Scana et al. And cortical bone stem cells modify cardiac inflammation after myocardial infarction by inducing a novel macrophage phenotype by Hobby et al. Why are we talking about these two articles again? Well, it's because they were a collaboration between the Hauser Lab and the McKinsey Lab. Alex and Gianna are both former Hauser Lab members who have gone on to pursue different post-Hauser Lab paths, which we think will be equally interesting to you, our listeners. Alex has pursued a postdoc position in the McKinsey Lab doing molecular studies, a big departure from the large animal studies he did in the Hauser Lab. Gianna has moved from academia to industry, working for Ragent Health, a healthcare business division of Ragent, which is working to launch a wearable health-related device later this year. Both Alex and Gianna have unique perspectives that will resonate with anyone determining which path to take next in their science career. Let's get started. Liz?
Thank you, Kara, for the introduction. I'm very excited to speak today with Alex and Gianna. I loved both papers. It's a lot of interest to me and my lab, especially both of you looked at fibroblasts and fibroblast phenotypes. So that was very exciting for me. And of course, we're also interested in myocardial infarction. We normally ask each of the speakers to give us a little summary of their manuscript in AJP Heart. So I will start with Alex because your manuscript came up first, and then Gianna can give us also a summary of your data and study design.
Great, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's really fun to sort of talk with you guys about science and not science. So what I did in Dr. Hauser's lab for pretty much the entirety of my PhD was take data in our large animal swine model of myocardial infarction and dig deeper into how we were getting the functional data in that large animal model. And what I mean by that is we were seeing efficacy, we were seeing improvement with our stem cell treatments at 3 months in these pigs, but not at 3 days. And so we termed this, you know, we did not have any acute cardioprotection, but we had longer lasting effects on scar size, but we didn't know how. And so my role in the lab was essentially using a combination of the large animal model and more cellular based assays to try to figure out how that was happening. And one thing that we landed on was inflammation and macrophages. So I found through studying macrophages in vitro, but also studying macrophages in our large animal model, which has not really been done much before at all, that the stem cells we were injecting were inducing this phenotype that we called novel, although that's up for debate in the field in general, but they were inducing a phenotype that we hadn't necessarily seen before, and that phenotype was beneficial. So I sort of connected the dots between stem cell therapy in large animal models and the inflammatory and healing crosstalk between macrophages and fibroblasts.
Thank you. Gianna?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me here today. Really excited to be on with all of you and to get some good old reminiscing time in with Alex from our time in the lab together. So what I worked on in Dr. Hauser's lab was really kind of on the other end of the spectrum of the similar project to what Alex was working on. So he was looking at the cortical bone stem cells effects in large animals. And I went all the way to the other end of the spectrum and was interested in the effect of not just our cortical bone stem cells, but their exosomes. And I looked at them in vitro and in a mouse model. I was interested more in the effect on wound healing in particular, and seeing how they would perhaps interact with the fibroblasts, since some of the studies that our lab had seen earlier on showed that there was less scarring long-term after an MI in both mice and in the swine. So we were interested in my project in really discovering what was causing that alteration to fibrosis. So I used exosomes from mice and implanted them into mice. And then we also were looking at finding our stem cells in human cortical bones. We were hoping to see if we could derive them. We think, I think it's still ongoing. We're still discovering whether or not we have, but we believed we had isolated human cortical bone stem cells from some samples that we had. And then I derived exosomes from them and treated human fibroblasts with those derived cortical bone stem cell exosomes and saw really powerful anti-fibrotic effects, particularly in the human stem cell. So we found that really interesting. And that research still continues forward to this day. And I'm excited to see how that turns out.
Excellent. I thought both of the manuscripts had such interesting data. And like Gianna said, there was similarities between the two studies, even though it was completely different models. So just from a technical point of view, I want to confirm some of those similarities. Was the delivery method for the cortical bone stem cells and the exosomes? I know Alex didn't use the exosomes, but for the stem cells, was the delivery method the same?
The delivery method was the same within my experiments, but it's not the same as looking at them in mice and pigs, because in mice, what we do is we crack the chest of the mice and we inject the stem cells or the exosomes or the vehicle directly into the tissue from the outside of the heart. And Alex can speak to this more, but for the pigs, you actually inject from the inside of the heart. So in terms of within my study, it was the same delivery method, but it's not the same across the two different papers.
Oh, okay. So you're injecting directly to the pericardium. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, Alex, were you systemically injecting? How were you doing it?
It's a great question. So we actually did all of our studies in the pigs through subcutaneous catheters that fed into the femoral artery and vein. So we used essentially imaging techniques that allowed us to see radio opaque implements and tools and parts of the body without actually opening the animal up. So we used these very long catheters that had needles on the end, and we were able to send that catheter up the femoral artery, bend it into the heart over the aortic arch, and actually inject through the leg up into the inside of the heart through that catheter. And so we were able to do all closed chest surgeries and use all surgical implements that are actually used in the cath lab on humans. That's one of the biggest benefits of using pigs. So we were able to inject in that way. And that also lended some novelty to our experiment as well, because not everybody does that. It takes a pretty large surgical setup to be able to do that. So I was very fortunate to be a part of those techniques.
Wow, that's fantastic. I feel, I'll be honest, very jealous right now. But okay, so for me, that was important to know because when I was looking at the data and trying to compare, of course, there was differences that I thought were very interesting, which is expected with different models. So for example, Gianna, you saw a beneficial reduction in the infarct size with both the cortical bone stem cells and also the exosomes, while Alex did not see any difference in the size of injury. Isn't that correct?
So yes, we did not see any functional beneficial effects at the 7-day time point, but we didn't expect to, because we hadn't seen any at 3 days either. And we were actually most interested in the cellular changes going on in the heart at that time point that led to the remodeling we saw months later. So my sort of end goal for the pig project was pretty different from the mouse project, the exosome project, but it also just speaks to differences in the model and our inability right now and our limitation as a field to compare models across species. So yeah, I think you hit it right on the head, and I'll let Gianna elaborate on the exosomes.
Yeah. So as Alex was saying, the models aren't exactly different. And honestly, the findings that we found in my study were really surprising to us, because we really strongly had believed as a lab that there was no cardioprotective effect from the stem cells. And that had been tested in a couple different ways. It had been tested in a paper a couple years before Alex and I joined the lab, where they looked to see cardioprotection following a permanent ligation MI. And they saw Jason Duram was the author of that paper, and they didn't see any cardioprotection when looking following the permanent ligation. And then we looked together actually with Tom Sharp to see if there was any cardioprotection in the pigs early on in our PhDs, and still had not seen any type of cardioprotection. So when we saw it in my mouse study, we were really surprised and honestly didn't fully believe the data. And it was the question that we pondered for the longest after kind of doing all of the analysis. And the conclusion that we came to try and make it all work in our heads is that the models, because they are unalike in a couple different ways, the most important way in which they were unalike that we think is what is leading to this cardioprotection is the fact that in both the permanent ligation MI in a mouse and in the study that we do in the large animals, there's a significant window of time following reperfusion, or if there is reperfusion, before you actually inject the therapies. Also, proportionally, the amount of exosomes or stem cells, which I'm able to inject into the mouse heart, is much greater than it is possible to inject in the pig heart. So in the study that I was doing, where we actually cracked the mouse's chest and we ligated and then untied that ligation later, we were able to inject the therapy pretty much within 10 to 15 seconds of reperfusion beginning. Whereas in the large animal study, there's some time following the actual moment of reperfusion before you're actually able to inject those therapies. And Alex can talk more about why that is part of the procedure if you're interested. But so that there's a difference in the amount of time that stretches out between the injury and the therapy. So we think that's really what is allowing that kind of immediate dampening of that injury effect.
I find this really interesting because, like Alex was saying, it's so difficult to compare between different animal models, even when we're looking at the same injury, the same type of injury. And every time in our lab, when we're considering bringing in a different animal, we always struggle on how to mimic the treatment, because you cannot just go by doing the same delivery amount by kilogram of, you know, body weight, because the mouse, for example, has a really high metabolism, which definitely doesn't compare to a pig. So it's such a struggle to be able to compare data across models. Can you just elaborate why do you have that technical period between the injury and the delivery?
Absolutely. So it's just a technical matter where, in order for us to do the injections, we have to map the inside of the heart with a catheter with an electrode on the tip that measures the conductivity of the heart tissue as it beats. So we get a 3D map of the left ventricle, and that process takes anywhere from 60 to 90 minutes. The other thing is that in an effort to make the model as translational as possible, that time is not necessarily a negative thing or a bad thing, because that's actually the 60 to 90 minutes is the average sort of time for a patient to get into the cath lab and get the myocardial infarction cleared and treated and everything. So between the time of the actual ischemia and the time of the mapping, we're recapitulating what a patient would actually go through in the event of a heart attack. So it's both a technical matter, and also it just is kind of a happy coincidence that it's also an experimental matter as well.
But one question that came to mind, you're talking about getting a patient into the cath lab in 90 minutes to an hour. That seems fast to me for someone. So that's like someone starts to have a heart attack to get to the hospital, right? And has anyone looked at this in women? Because I know the time it takes for women to get to the hospital with heart attacks, because they present differently, et cetera, they take longer than men in general. So has anyone looked at this in female animals?
That's a fantastic question. So for a totally unrelated reason, all of our pigs were female. So the timing was not sort of the determining factor on that, but we used female pigs for an unrelated reason that I can get into. But it has to do with injecting male cells and looking for the Y chromosome, which was just an easier way to find the cells. But in terms of the actual timing, you know, as Gianna mentioned, Tom Sharp, our predecessor in the large animal lab, he had already done, and he and people before him as well, had already done studies with this protocol sort of mapped out. And this was decided with a clinician who was sort of consulting on the model. And that time frame was decided well before my time in the lab. So we stuck with it, but I do think it's an important question in terms of the actual efficacy of treatment. But it speaks more to the translational nature of the pig model versus more experimental nature of a mouse model.
The data was amazing. Not only the like Gianna's that showed such a strong antifibrotic fibroblast phenotype with the exosomes, that was quite impressive, but also the macrophage shift that Alex was looking at for a more pro-reparative type of population. So I know Gianna's was a shorter term study, but you still looked in the beginning at the inflammatory cells, and then you did your in vitro experiments with the fibroblasts. And Alex, you were talking a lot about the crosstalk between macrophages and fibroblasts. So how long do you think the exosomes stay in place when you deliver them? Or I know, of course, the paracrine effects will initiate a cascade. So do you believe that the whatever signaling pathways that the exosomes are initiating, will this continue until long-term remodeling?
So were you a closet member of my thesis committee? Because I actually
That was a secret. How do you know? I was just kidding.
This is a very familiar question. I will say that I do believe that the exosomes, they don't stay for long. And I know we both know how the paracrine signaling effect works. But I think the way that the data kind of summed up what we thought was going on there really showed that it was the exosomes microRNA and perhaps even their snow RNA content that was binding to the fibroblasts and most likely other cells, but we particularly looked at the fibroblasts, binding particularly to the mRNA related to both creating and functioning ribosomes. So it was that initial kind of dampening of the inflammatory response that I think led to the improvements that I saw in the short term. Now, I will say that whenever I finished, if I had stayed on longer, what we would have done next would be to do exactly the same experimental model, but then take it out longer over time, because most of the members of my thesis committee and also I myself believe that it's really, the question is that effect going to continue past a week or two, or are you going to see a drop off? Is it kind of a temporary blunting of the effect of the injury, or have we really changed the long-term remodeling? Hard to say without actually doing the experiment.
And this is another pro and con sort of weighing your options thing with cells versus exosomes as well, because we know the cells are in the tissue in mice up to a month. And I know for a fact in pig, they're there at 3 days, 7 days and beyond as well. So I kind of think of the stem cells as little paracrine factories having all these effects. And in my mind, they do stick around longer than exosomes, although I haven't done that study. I'm not 100% certain of that, but again, you saw acute cardioprotection with exosomes, while with cells, you didn't. So, there's these pros and cons to either. And so it really makes for an interesting contrast between the two techniques and the two treatments. And there's another, decades worth of studies that could be done trying to figure out, which is best.
Yeah, I will say, as we were discussing the results after the end of my thesis presentation, my committee members and I, particularly Dr. Kishore, we theorized that perhaps the perfect concoction would be a cocktail of the two together, that you would put the exosomes in the initial one, as well as stem cells. So you get your kind of initial burst, and then the stem cells, the ones that do implant and engraft, could continue to produce said exosomes along with everything else they do for all the time they remain in the tissue.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea. It would be a great experiment to do. It's too bad, we're not there to do it, but it would be very interesting to see. And I think the clinical trials that have gone on with exosomes and stem cells, I think people are moving in the direction of trying to combine therapies and see sort of the optimal mix of things. I also got a lot of questions of, well, if it's the Paracrine effect, why don't you just inject media, conditioned media or something like that? So, you know, my response was, well, wouldn't you want the cells to stay there and make it longer anyways? So yeah, it's a pretty big area of debate. It's something that we've both been asked many times, and it's a really interesting area for future experiments.
Okay, so I think we can move to some questions about your professional choices and career paths, which are very interesting, in my opinion. You both come from the same lab, so you would assume you had a very similar type of training, and you chose very different pathways. What I'm interested in knowing is if during your graduate program, did you have access to specific education in career paths or some resources that you could take advantage of to decide exactly what you want to do after your PhD?
I would say, I think that my biggest resource, and I hope that Alex thinks the same, was absolutely our mentor, Dr. Hauser. Temple has a very good program where you can talk to people who have been in the labs before and gone on to other things. And sometimes they end up coming back anyways. It's kind of that kind of culture there where you want to revisit. But I found that Dr. Hauser was a fantastic resource as a mentor. And he really pushed both of us to go to many conferences. And he actually focused on having us go to smaller conferences when we were training, because he thought it was actually a better way to get exposed to people in the field and people that had chosen to move on to do different things. He said, while he enjoys the large conferences on a personal level, the smaller conferences are more valuable in kind of getting more feedback from people that are a little further down the pathway than we are ourselves. Alex?
Yeah, I would totally agree. I think Steve was my biggest resource, but I think the best resource for professional development in general are the people around you. And I kind of found that at Temple to be pretty easy to access. We had people from all different backgrounds, all different career backgrounds, and I was able to get in touch with people that had done a lot of different things. And I love talking to people. And so I talk to people as much as I can. And it's no accident that I'm here in Tim McKinsey's lab. And that sort of connection was something that came about through Steve as well. So yeah, I think the biggest resource I had, and I think we both had, were the people around us.
I think it's fantastic that you both had such a good mentor that you could lean on for advice for your career. That's really what we hope that is happening for every trainee. I was asking because this year I had the opportunity to talk with a lot more graduate students from different labs and even different institutions. And I don't know if unfortunately was also a result of the isolation we had to go through in the last year and a half, 2 years. I felt like the students that graduated last year or within the last, let's say, 4 months, they felt a little bit lost. And one of the main things they kept telling me were they did not have the opportunity to go to as many conferences as they hoped for, because when they had the data to start sharing, it was the time the labs closed and we were doing everything digitally. So they lost a lot of that person-to-person connection. And many of them were not able to decide what they want to do after their PhD. So some of them are still thinking, others have moved on. The majority, you know, it's easier to get into academia than if you don't have a lot of resources or a lot of knowledge about other types of jobs. So a couple of them, I know they're now doing a postdoc, but they're still not certain if that's really what they want to do. In which year did you guys graduate?
It was 2020.
It feels like years ago. I guess it was years ago now, but it feels like longer than years ago. But yeah, 2020. And I just, you know, we could do a whole separate podcast on research during COVID times. Mm-hmm. I think I might have been like the second or third person to defend virtually after one of our friends, Mike, defended. And it's just a totally different ball game, it felt like. And so I had a little bit more sort of lined up as to what I wanted to do, but I totally understand sort of what your students are going through, what all grad students right now are going through, is just the collaborative nature of science is what makes it so much fun and what makes it special. And it's been really hard to have that over the last couple of years. But I think we're adapting as a field, and I think there will be more opportunities for that, certainly as COVID, hopefully, fingers crossed, wanes. I'm also in the same boat. I'm doing my postdoc now, and I don't know exactly what I want to do next, but I think the best thing to do is just never stop sort of exploring and never stop trying to figure out what that next thing will be.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with Alex on that. So obviously I made a very different choice than Alex, but honestly, it was very much impacted by COVID and the environment that I was in trying to finish my PhD. So whenever we kind of all locked down, I had been probably about 6 months from the end of where I would expect to be finished. And I really had maybe 3 experiments left in order to actually finish and write up my dissertation and get out. But because I was locked at home and unable to get into the lab, I actually ended up strategizing together with a friend. And that's how I actually ended up at the business that I'm at now. It was in figuring out new ways to create data and to make connections and collaborations in a world in which you actually can't meet people in person and can't do experiments in person. So I would completely piggyback off of Alex and say, just never stop trying and don't let it get you down, because while it's been unbelievably difficult, there are opportunities for those who are stubborn and determined enough to seek for them, which I really think is a pretty common personality trait in the researchers that I know. People are determined to be successful in their goals.
That's beautiful. I'm really loving this conversation about the journey and how you get to where you're going. I think it always looks so nice in hindsight, you know. I was wondering, so you guys pursued such different career paths for different reasons. So I was wondering if you could do a quick little timeline of like what brought you to the Hauser Lab in the first place. It sounds like a wonderful environment. So, you know, why did you come and what was your journey like? You know, at what point did you, Alex, realize you wanted to do a postdoc? And Jan, I guess we have spoilers now because we know that it was towards the end where you decided to get into healthcare. But how did you find that journey? Because I think that's something that I see my own students struggling with, is the pressure of trying to figure out what you want to do and that the bit of the roller coaster as you go through that process.
Well, Alex, I honestly feel like the beginning of this journey was the same for both of us, since we took it literally together. I remember Dr. Hauser, the way that Temple works for you kind of rotating through your labs and deciding on your labs is that the PIs who are interested and have available spots, they actually come and present to the first years and talk about their labs and the kind of work that they do. You know, they try and give you a little hint of the environments before you even choose the labs to rotate through. And I remember that day I was really interested in Dr. Hauser's discussion of his lab because of the kind of things that he said we'd have the opportunity to do. For instance, work with the pigs. I still remember to this day, I guess 6 or 7 years later now, him saying some grad students just really love to get their hands dirty. And I was like, that's going to be me. So from that moment, I decided I was going to rotate in his lab. And I think, Alex, you had a pretty similar experience with Hauser that day.
Yeah, I saw his presentation, and I'm a very, I don't want to say analytical, but I saw the resources that Steve had. I saw the incredible nature of the work he was doing. And I said to myself, this guy is doing the coolest stuff at Temple. I want to work in his lab. Mm-hmm. And we both rotated at different times. And actually the PIs are limited to 2 students per class. And Steve took 3 that year because he could. So we all came in together, Jocelyn, Gianna, and I, and Yijun as well, who is a little bit separate in terms of programs. Mm-hmm. And so he had a big influx of students, and we all just started putting our heads down and working. Charlotte, I totally agree with you. The rose-tinted glasses on sort of career journeys is a real thing. The path seems straight when you're not walking it, but when you are walking it, obviously it is anything but. So Gianna, I'll let you sort of finish your journey and then I'll speak up with mine. But yeah, it's never a straight line. Never.
I definitely agree. So now looking back, it seems easy for me to say, oh, I couldn't go to work during COVID. And then I invented a new way to create publishable results. And then boom, I started working at this new company where we focus on finding ways to make healthcare and research more accessible to people, but that's not the long and short of it. So what really happened is, you know, we were locked out of the lab, and like most people were feeling, I was feeling super isolated and not really sure how on earth to navigate the world after COVID, still thinking about, you know, it was going to be done soon. So by the time I finish, it'll be an after COVID moment. And in thinking about that, I talked to a friend of mine pretty often about what were we going to do? You know, the world had completely changed. All the things we thought we were going to do afterwards, none of them were relevant anymore. And we said, well, why don't we figure out, based on some of the growing pains that we had during our PhDs, why don't we try and address some of those problems together and see if we can make not just our lives more interesting, but actually try and help future grad students to not have to deal with the same problems that we did during our PhDs. And that conversation, which actually happened over my dinner table one night, I think in October of 2020, led to us joining the healthcare division at the company Ragent 4 months later. And really, we weren't even connected to their mission. It was just like the people that were involved, they knew it was tangential to what they were working on. And they thought the opportunity here could be really big. And these two students are excited, but also don't have the resources to go after this idea on their own. So let's give them a shot and see what they do. And it's been, I guess, just under a year since I started in this job. And it has been both the longest and shortest year of my life. Every single day is intense, unpredictable. I work 100, 120 hour weeks, and I love it. It's the hardest thing I've ever done, but I love it.
So let me see if I understood this correctly. You and your friends approached this company with an idea of what you wanted to do, or they had a program that you volunteered to?
So the backstory here is that this company had been working during COVID to create a division that was going to use artificial intelligence and combine it with different kinds of wearables and different data that's gathered around people, and see if you could use that all together to either make monitoring disease better or even perhaps move into AI being assistive in diagnosis. And what my friend and I were talking about was kind of tangential to that, because ultimately it could assist in diagnosis. But the idea we were talking about was actually how to deal with the difficulties of analyzing different sequencing research during your PhD. And in particular, we'd built a pipeline to actually automate how that processing happens. And in order to test our pipeline, what we experimented on was data that we pulled from NCBI's online warehouse, where you actually have to publish any of your seq data if you publish a paper that was supported by public funding. In order to publish that paper, you have to publish all of your seq. And generally, as we all know in academia, if we're doing an experiment that involves sequencing, we're generally looking for a really particular target. We're not necessarily curious about the full raw data. You know, we have a certain question that we're pursuing. But we said, why don't we see if we can actually go back and pool multiple different sources of sequencing data, and in doing so, artificially create larger sample sizes. And in doing that, could we perhaps tease out new things from the data that wouldn't have been possible, you know, given how difficult it is sometimes to create large sample sizes, particularly in sequencing data that's related to humans or clinical trials. So what we had actually done is, to prove that this pipeline could produce something interesting, we had our pipeline pull any sequencing files from NCBI Geo that were related to men and women that had the same disease, which for our purposes, we analyzed data related to dilated cardiomyopathy. We wanted to see if we ran it through our system, would we discover anything in common, or would we discover that men and women, while having both having the same disease, are their genetic signatures different in any way? And from that difference, could we find something useful about perhaps treating the disease in men or women? We'd built this pipeline and we showed this example. And what we discovered was actually that the disease, which looks the same on the surface of dilated cardiomyopathy, at the genetic level is entirely different in men and women. So that was really interesting to us, but also to this other company that was thinking about analyzing healthcare and looking at people's data and trying to figure out a more personalized way to look at their bodies and diagnose disease. whenever we were able to show that we could analyze these data and discover not just what's different, but we actually took a step further to, because of what is different, are there any pharmaceuticals that could treat the signature of the disease that was really different in women? And that was what the idea that they said, well, that has really a lot of merit. If we can discover what's different about your disease and then go from that even forward to what is different about your disease that we could actually treat, that's potentially a really valuable idea. So that's the moment at which they decided to bring us on and have us kind of run our own division, which is what we're doing now and is really, really fun.
I mean, that's amazing. I'm very happy for you.
Thank you.
And you know, what a conversation, like you said, at a dinner table led to completely different career path. And now you're running your own division. That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow, Gianna. Wow. Amazing.
Thanks.
So Alex, you're up. Poor guy's got to follow that now.
I'm sure he'll be able to.
Yeah. So I'm a little more sort of in the nitty gritty still in academia. As we've already talked about, my experience in Steve's lab was all sort of physiology and large animal work. And I realized that my biggest scientific blind spots were the cellular and molecular techniques that I wasn't doing. So I didn't even have a lot of experience doing Western blots. I was doing almost entirely flow cytometry and these large animal studies and then some in vitro macrophage work. So in thinking about my own sort of career development, I decided that the best thing for me to do skills-wise would be to go and do the exact opposite of what I had been doing for the last 5 years and go into a lab that does almost exclusively cellular molecular biology. So that was a rough transition, and it was something that I had to grit my teeth a little bit and get through in the beginning. But I will say that now, almost exactly a year later, I am much more comfortable sort of in my role as a postdoc. And I'm looking at right now, still actually working with macrophages, although in an entirely different context. But I'm looking at the sort of acetylation state of specific proteins on the nuclear pore and how those proteins are controlling the efflux and influx of transcription factors and things like that. And my work is sort of more on the back end of pharmaceutical development. Tim has a background in industry as well, which is another reason I came to his lab. And he has setups here basically to do these big drug screens and high throughput, high content assays, which I actually have some of in my paper. And so I'm also involved in looking at developing assays in which we can use small molecules or epigenetic inhibitors or things like that to look at the ability of those compounds to change the phenotype of cells in a way that might lead to the development of pharmaceuticals down the line. And this is on purpose, but I'm in kind of an odd position where I am straddling a little bit academia and industry because I want to do science, but I also want to do science in also more of a business setting. And so I'm not just doing sort of traditional academic research necessarily. I do have an eye on industry and drug development as well. So that's all sort of developed quickly and slowly. Again, I would definitely echo the fact that the last year has been the slowest and fastest of my life, what Gianna said. But yeah, it's fun. It's a ton of work. And the bar is very high here. But I think as long as you put in the hours and you put in the work and you're sort of committed to the science, I think it's absolutely worth it. And it has been a really fun time because I love Colorado. That's another big bonus for being here. So it's been really nice to have long days in the lab overlooking the Rocky Mountains. It's been really fantastic. So yeah, a little bit more of a traditional role, but I also am kind of incorporating things that you wouldn't necessarily do in academia in a traditional postdoc as well. So I've had my own winding road, so to speak.
I want to take one quick second and say wow to Alex so that he gets his wow too. And just
thank you. I appreciate it.
Alex, I really love you talking about doing the things that are difficult and that scare you. And I think that's a great message for all of our trainees listening, that it's definitely easier to stay in your box. And I think most people who get into research, you know, we like being good at things and we like doing the things that we're good at. And it can be very, very hard to push yourself out of that box. And I think both of you have done exactly that. Choose the things that are hard. And I think that's the only way that you find, you know, what you really love. So this has been a really inspiring conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to both of you. So thank you for being so candid and so open. This was so nice.
Yes, thank you. I totally agree. I really appreciate your guys' time and I appreciate you having us on. It's been really fun.
Yeah, it's been great to be here. Thanks again for having us.
So this is Charlotte and Liz and Alex and Gianna and of course our fearless organizer, Kara Keehan, for Behind the Bench. Please join us next time. We'll see you soon.
Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.